On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Comcast is under fire again because of their hidden fees and couldn't get the case thrown out. Social networks don't want bots scraping their data, and VMware comes to the show to talk about secure digital workspaces. Twyatt on The Set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 251, recorded August 4th, 2017. Secure Digital Workspaces.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Amazon Kinesis from AWS, a powerful new way to easily collect, process, and analyze streaming data so you can get timely insights and react quickly to new information. Learn more at kinesis.aws.
Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of enterprise. But as you know, this world is a pretty large place, and I need another expert to help me guide along. And of course, that person is going to be Mr. Brian Chi, the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. So, Chibert, have you had a chance to build your Raspberry Pi VPN yet?
I've actually built several, and I'm just trying to make it nice and clean. I'm tinkering. I'm trying to see if I can make it fit on a Pi Zero. Not so sure I can, but ought to be interesting.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm actually going to try it. You sent out a cool little go-to and how-to. I'm going to try it out myself, so we'll see how it goes. But well, folks, of course, today we have a pretty great show, and we're going to talk a little bit about how cable companies are under fire because of their service fees, maybe based on some information about the legality of web page scraping, as well as we have VMware to talk a little bit about digital workspaces. But first, we want to get into the blips. You may have heard that the TV Add-ons PC software is a catalog of hundreds of thousands of apps known as add-ons, which help Android TV boxes actually work. And these are TV boxes, which allow you to have free TV. Once you download it on the Android box, you have the ability to have such things as Exodus and One Channel, which gives people access to pirated movies, TV shows, and television. Well, the cable companies Bell Rogers and Videotron are not going to take it anymore. Last year, they started their campaign to start suing some of the creators of the Android box. But this time they filed suit against TV add-ons itself and their creator, Adam Lachman, saying that developing this software and making even it available to the public has interfered with the Copyright Act. Lachman argues TV add-ons doesn't actually host any of the private content or the pirated content, but instead it connects users to sources already available online. So it doesn't. So it basically just serves as a search engine in this case. So it sounds like if someone created a device that can basically do a Google search for you that will produce this information, you could be subject to suit as well. The worst part of the suit, though, is started with a civil search warrant, which allowed them to do a 16-hour search and questioning session with Adam, and he was actually questioned through the entire process, as well as even threatened if he didn't answer any things, he would be put in contempt of court. Luckily, the judge was on his side, and he didn't want to permit these types of threats going forward, so he put the kibosh on the TV providers. One hopes this type of bullying by telecoms won't start a trend of companies like this going after the little guy.
Well, IBM and Sony just released details on a 330 terabyte tape system. Just when I thought tape was a dead technology for the enterprise, IBM and Sony just came up with a brand new tape and tape drive technology that could potentially reliably store up to 330 terabytes on a single tape cartridge. Unlike the old wet squeegee process for magnetic oxide coated Mylar tape systems, this new system is sputtered to get extremely thin and accurate media. And they've created a self-lubricating layer to solve the unrolling snags that plagued older tape systems. IBM's contribution is a revolutionary new tape read-write head and transport system that can handle the insane data densities of the new Sony storage medium. What I'm waiting for is word on the guesstimated shelf life of the tapes, since that's an awful lot of data to lose in a single tiny cartridge.
So Firefox is on the warpath, and although it changes daily, here's a quick snapshot of the data on browser wars. Google Chrome looks to have 54% of the market, Safari about 14%, Firefox about 7%, and IE dropping to about 13%. And of course, Microsoft Edge is roughly around 5%. Well, Firefox looks to differentiate itself come this November, where they will debut Firefox 57. What's the differentiator? Well, this release includes a massive overhaul of its technology stack, UI, as well as their project called Quantum, which will help improve security and performance by squeezing every little bit of performance out of every layer of the browser technology stack. Based on all the new platform on this particular platform, Firefox's performance actually has increased 38% on macOS and 45% on Windows. There's a lot of room for improvement on browsers, of course. We'll have to see if Firefox is ready to take on the rest of the world.
Forget the front door. Your garage door is your weakest link. Sorry, folks. I know it's sexy to get a biometric lock for your front door, but all it takes is 30 seconds and a wire coat hanger to break into your typical garage door. That little rope hanging down is a safety release, and reaching in with a coat hanger means a thief can flip that latch and get into your garage in under 30 seconds. Once in, the thief is out of sight and able to take their time breaking into the house. What LiftMaster is now offering, actually it's LiftMaster and Chamberlain, is an electronic deadbolt synchronized with your garage door opener to prevent this from happening. I'm actually looking at hacking something similar so that I would need to use my iPhone's Touch ID to authenticate before I can open the garage door. While it sounds like overkill, look in your garage. Less than 10% of homes have a deadbolt on their door that leads from the garage into your home.
So you may have heard this past week there were actually some leaks coming from HBO. Was it a hack? Well, it's still being investigated, but so far the information leaked is pointing to a yes. In this particular leak, hackers claim that it's stolen 1.5 terabytes worth of data. This could only be video footage. It could only be, but you know, obviously the size of HD video and audio leads to believe that it could be actually other data as well. Imagine how long it took to actually siphon that amount of data out of their system. Why HBO didn't know what was going on while it was happening, maybe throwing up a red flag here and there, we don't know. But hackers have actually published some scripts from upcoming episodes in order to prove the hack. HBO was publicly stating that they don't actually think that internal emails or customer data was part of the breach at the time. But its earnings on this past Wednesday, Time Warner said its subscriptions of HBO have jumped by 106 million and an increase of 8%. So it doesn't actually seem to be affecting the bottom line just yet. If this is actually a real hack, you can bet that the hacker group responsible will surface some proof pretty soon.
The Malwarebytes annual ransomware report is saying that 32% of small to medium businesses were hit last year. The report goes on to say that of those hit, one-fifth had to stop operations immediately. They also lament that it really only takes a single person to cripple an organization and that they're seeing a significant increase in human factor hacking. They're also of the opinion that a lot of the attackers are becoming aware that they can make small amounts of money on a grand scale very quickly through automation. Their example is that if hackers send out 100,000 emails and 10,000 users click on it at $200 apiece, well, that's a lot of money. The reality is that user education needs to be an important part of any security plan, and I'm hoping that K-12 education is adding this to the curriculum so that at least the next generation might be less susceptible to itchy clicky fingers.
So some of you might have heard of John Oliver. He's an English comedian, talk show host, political commentator. Well, he's fairly outspoken about net neutrality as well, and in the past, the SEC has claimed that one of his shows actually led to a distributed DDoS attack back in May. Well, what has unfolded since then has surfaced a bit of confusion, especially from the FCC. When asked for evidence of the cyber attack from regulators, senators, and journalists, the FCC refused to share any data. The FCC also refused to respond to several Freedom of Information Act requests around the DDoS attacks. What made this even more confusing was that several news outlets actually are claiming the FCC doesn't have any documentation or data around the attack. While FCC has put out a statement attempting to debunk those claims, they basically are saying they have tons of documentation in this attack in the form of logs collected by other commercial cloud partners. EgyptPie has claimed transparency for this particular commission, which also is adding to the confusion, seeing that they're not releasing any information. Hopefully the FCC can clear things up soon to ensure a clear highway for them to tackle some of the growing challenges surrounding the communication sector going forward. Good luck, FCC. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. And next up, of course, we're going to jump into the bites. We have some pretty cool information coming towards you. But of course, first, we couldn't do this week at Enterprise Tech without our great supporters and our fabulous sponsors. And this particular one, Leo wants to tell you about it. Leo?
If you don't mind, I'd like to just stick my foot in the door here on this segment of This Week in Enterprise Tech to tell you a little bit about our sponsor, and a really great sponsor it is. I don't have to tell you about Amazon Web Services. I mean, if you're in business and you're not using Amazon Web Services, why not? And especially if you're looking at a better way to collect and process and analyze streaming data from your apps, your websites, you know, IoT sensors. Today, we have when you've got customers using your stuff, there's a lot of data points that you can get. And it can be so valuable if you could just get them in real time. Websites, mobile apps, IoT sensors, they can generate so much streaming data, like terabytes an hour. And if you could just get into that and process it, you'd get such great insights into what your customers are doing right now, what they need, what they don't like, but how your applications are doing, how your website's doing. That's what Kinesis does. Amazon Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, from Amazon Web Services. Data is the new gold. Data is, in business, if you aren't looking at the data, you're missing the biggest revolution to happen in business since the calculator, since IBM, right? There's no better data than real-time data, because that's what's happening right now with your customers and your apps. Amazon Kinesis is a great way to collect, process, and analyze the streaming data. With just a few clicks, you can start sending data from hundreds of thousands of data sources simultaneously, load them in real time, process them, analyze the data, take action, and all you need to do, or your engineers need to do, is know SQL. If you know SQL, you know the SQL query language, that's all you need. You can query Kinesis and find out, get all sorts of insights. And you have the flexibility to build your own custom applications. Of course, you can use all the popular stream processing frameworks you choose. With Kinesis, you only pay for the resources you use. And that's one of the things I love about AWS. There's no minimum, no upfront commitments. You pay for what you use, and that makes it very affordable. And by the way, transformational for your business. I want you to go to kinesis.aws and learn more. K-I-N-E-S-I-S. K-I-N-E-S-I-S.aws. And let's get streaming. Kinesis.aws. I love having Amazon Web Services as a sponsor for This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's like peanut butter and jelly. They just go together. Now we send you back to Twyatt. Thanks.
Definitely is peanut butter and jelly. Thank you to Amazon AWS for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, on to the bites. So cable companies just can't get themselves out of the news, especially in light of all the discussions around net neutrality. Well, this time it's about all about the Benjamins. We reported previously on how the state of New York wasn't going to take it anymore when Charter Spectrum wasn't delivering on their claims of network speeds and internet customers. Well, Comcast is back in the news this time due to their ongoing battle of hidden fees against customers. Many of the mobile telecom corporations have been under fire by customers offering low monthly contracted rates, but forgetting to tell you about all the fees and hidden tax costs. In fact, Verizon was recently misrepresenting tax and fees on customers' bills, which means, in fact, the Federal Universal Service Fund surcharges and of course, administrative fees and other things. In fact, T-Mobile is actually banking on this by actually having their own campaign and advertising that their service plans include that stuff. Well, it seems Comcast is not innocent in this process either. Not only has Comcast raided dead last in customer service in the past 7 years. It's also having several suits pertain to misrepresented fees, hidden costs, and charging more than advertised. So last August, Washington actually slapped a $100 million suit on Comcast for basically $1.8 million violations of the state's Consumer Protection Act due to a $4.99 per month service protection plan on people's bills. Well, back in this past October, Comcast was also had a file a suit against them where it basically claimed they advertised low prices, poorly disclosed fees to increase the amount of paid by cable TV providers, customers. So some of these fees were Comcast broadcast TV fee, which increased $150 to $650 since 2014. And another one called regional sports fee, which has gone from $1 to actually $4.50 since 2015. This lawsuit also calls out about how people have signed a multi-year contract with Comcast and they're not even safe to some of these hikes and some of these hidden fees. So this is pretty interesting to hear because, you know, I've personally fell victim to this and myself. I have Comcast Business and I have a multi-year contract. So often what happens is my modem price, since it's not part of the contract and the overall fees, it goes actually hiked a little bit, 80 cents here, a dollar here. It could be several months. It could be several quarters, but it doesn't get hiked. So I actually have to give them a call and say what's going on. In fact, some of my fees actually went up just recently as well. So this kind of leads to the disclaimer of what's going on here. Like, for instance, Cheever, is this the world that we live in now? Do ISPs and service providers get to do this? They get to battle it out by saying they had the lowest prices, but then they hide their costs and fees underneath?
You know, I don't know. I'm sick of it. You know, there's got to be a better way. You know, I love people, you know, that, you know, I love the regionals, you know, like Sonic and so forth, which is a Twit sponsor. I am sick and tired of these fees. What really chaps my whatevers is that you call them up and say, "What is this? Where did these fees come?" "I'm sorry, sir. We have no control over government fees." "Oh, really? Those aren't really government fees. What they're doing is they're just feeding into a pot to support the pieces that aren't making as much money." I'm sorry. You know, this really bugs me. And the worst part is these fees are getting dropped onto the consumer, whether it's a TV subscriber or an internet subscriber. They're saying it's government fees. Government, you know, stop blaming the government. In fact, I kind of wonder why the Federal Trade Commission hasn't gotten involved, because we have basically Comcast and probably a few other vendors saying, they're blaming extra fees onto the government when those aren't really government fees. Stop and think about that.
So this is an interesting take. This past week, there was actually a little bit of a different vector in the case itself, because it's been going on for a while. And in fact, this past week, Comcast tried to file a motion to dismiss, claiming that in order to submission process, they could not actually have created a contract that customers agreed to pay the fees in the subscriber agreement or in the minimum term agreement. Well, the U.S. District Court judge wasn't going to have any of that, and he denied the request to dismiss. And I quote, he says, "Plausible to infer from the complaint that by clicking submit your order, Adkins and Robinson agreed to pay Comcast advertised price plus taxes and government-related fees in exchange for services Comcast offered them. It's also plausible to infer that the complaint that Comcast breached its agreements with the plaintiff when it sent them bills charging the broadcast TV and regional sports fees in excess of the agreed-upon price and when subsequently sought to raise the amount of fees behind the scenes." So I think basically what the judge is saying is, you know, you guys are going to have to battle out in court. This is not as easy as an open and closed case. You know, it's time that you fess up and you tell the customers why you are charging these things, even though you've advertised it differently. In fact, I've had an opportunity when I used to have DirecTV. They were horrendous in this aspect. I used to get charged $39 a month. I had a 2-year contract with them. But then after all the fees and taxes, it actually came out to $59 a month. I mean, that's $20 more. If you think about it, I could have gone to some other provider that would have provided me, you know, same, if not similar, if not better service for that time. So I think you're right. I think it's time that maybe some kind of a commission or some kind of protection agency jumps in. You know, I was thinking maybe even the consumer protection agency can jump in here to kind of administer these types of things going forward, just to make sure that the companies are, you know, following this and that, you know, protecting customers behind the bottom line. I don't know. What do you think, Cheaper?
Yeah. You know, I've seen a trend of people saying, I'm just not going to do it anymore. You know, they're cord cutting like crazy. And actually, I saw this really interesting meme on the internet just the other day. Millennials discover how to get free programming with this new device called an antenna. Wow. Just wow. Right. Yeah. And the reality is I don't think the mobile carriers are that much better. You know, we've all seen that commercial of the little girl with the lemonade stand. Price advertised as a dollar, but she's handing the guy a bill for $2.45, and she starts listing off all the fees. So this is definitely something that's not just them. However, a whole lot of people that I know are thinking really hard because of the way advanced LTE is going. I know of at least a half a dozen folks here at the University of Hawaii that have said, I'm done. I'm not going to get a wired telephone line, and I'm not going to get cable TV, because I'm fine with using Netflix or Hulu or whatever, and I'm just going to do it over an LTE modem. JJ, yes, there are low caps and all that kind of good stuff. Ought to be interesting, especially with the new things that are happening on the advanced LTE. I actually did some testing. We did some work with the Honolulu Marathon. We were actually getting 100 meg symmetrical on advanced LTE, which is not so horrible.
Right. So I think another last interesting kind of take on this is that I actually have seen in some of the agreements that some companies are making you sign a 2-year agreement that actually waives your right to a lawsuit, which requires you to only go through arbitration. In fact, I was going to lease a modem for internet a couple years back, and I just basically walked out because they were going to make me actually sign an arbitration agreement as well that went along with it. It's kind of hidden in the small print. So these are just interesting tactics, I think, going forward for some of these companies, and we're just going to have to be really careful about what you're signing. Hopefully there'll be some other opportunities there for other ISPs to come in, as well as other TV providers to come in, and hopefully we'll have choice. All right, folks, I think we've beaten that one to death. Let's move on to the next one. So you all probably heard of the CFAA, which essentially is a amendment to the Counterfeit Access Device and Abuse Act. It makes it illegal for a whole bunch of stuff related to computers and computer networks, from stealing government documents to committing fraud and sending out spammy emails. It's extremely broad law, which means a lot of activities get pushed under one big umbrella, and it's been amended pretty much on a regular basis. It calls out several rules, and in fact includes obtaining information and from a protected computer. And what obtaining information means is a little broad. It can mean a whole range of things, from downloading top secrets to nuclear launch codes to actually loading just web page data. So every website you go to, every single social network you've joined, every internet connected service has a terms of service. Even your ISP is a term of service. So what prosecutors are saying can actually say, you know, if they can actually argue in some cases that the CFAA could actually be a violation of the terms of service. Now, the use of CFAA has been pretty controversial in the past, and it has many different interpretations. In fact, in this particular case, they're saying that web scraping does violate terms of service. But the question here is, does it actually have a conviction under CFAA? So this is interesting. So we all know what web scraping is. It's basically you're crawling the web, or you're basically, it's an automated piece of software that will go and extract data from a website. It scrapes all the data from the website. It's similar to how search engines actually do it. In fact, search engines go above and beyond that. They actually index all the data and text on your actual web page, so this way you can search it. But in this practice, a lot of people want to protect their competitive data. So you'll see, you know, a lot of these social networks, they have terms of service when you sign in that says the data, once you sign up and you sign in, all the data behind this sign-in gate is protected by our terms of service. But the question is, how protected is it? Cheever, what do you think here? Is it since it is a public free site, it's a social network, is, you know, in this case it's LinkedIn that's actually saying that, hey, I'm going to file suit against somebody because they created a bot that's scraping useful data off of our site and we don't even know what they're doing with it. Is that protected data? Is that something that they can protect behind a terms of service?
Heck of a good question if you ask me. I don't know. This is definitely something that I figure someone like Denise Howell and company will talk about. Now, I do draw some analogies that if someone goes in and, say, makes a copy of a library's card catalog and doesn't, you know, adds to it. Or let's get a better analogy. The academic papers in the world, we, you know, as academics, we publish them and we put them out into the world. Sometimes we actually have to pay to get those published. But once we publish it, the people go out and the database firms will actually go and grab that data, which is technically in the public domain, and then sell it to people as a, quote, service ad, because they're indexing it and so forth and adding peer review. Yeah, sure. So I don't see too much difference. There is definitely some problems with the, you know, there's issues with both sides. You know, both have good arguments. But if you're making the data available to the world free, and all you're doing is you're collecting user information, good question. Don't know. I think we're going to have one heck of an interesting fight in the legal system.
Right. I think, you know, so the chat room is actually pointing this out. No Media's, I think, is what pointed out is, you know, if you are, you know, signing up for something and they have a terms of service and it's gated behind that terms of service, it sounds like this could also be valid. But the question is, you know, let me take it from a startup's perspective. So I'm a startup. I'm starting a new site. And I'm in a really competitive space with really valuable data behind my signup wall. And I require users to log in and I get data and the login has the terms of service, obviously. But for some reason, because if someone were to come along and write some bot to start siphoning data out of that site, now my site could potentially be doomed. So the question here is, you know, is this something that is violating CFAA? I guess that would be a question back to you, Cheever. What do you think? Is this that bad that we're stealing computer secrets?
You know, I don't know. When we start talking about by clicking here, you agree to my terms of service, that sounds like the old shrink wrap argument. And we saw that go back and forth in court. And if I remember right, the shrink wrap argument kind of got thrown out, saying that the consumer has to be able to go and opt out of the terms of service and return it, even if the shrink wrap had been opened. I don't think this is too different. Dude, I don't know. This is why lawyers actually do need to exist, but also why lawyers are evil.
Right. Speck says it funny. He says, you stepped on my lawn, you're now my terms of service. And I agree. I think there's some validity there, I think. You know, the interesting part here, though, is and this suit actually points it out, is that search engines kind of get a pass for this. They're almost like whitelisted in some cases. And, you know, whether they're paying for this data, we don't know. But I would I throw it back to you, Cheever. What do you think? Should search engines just get a pass for this? I mean, aren't they essentially a bot that scrapes data from a site, makes it more useful, and creates a catalog of data for people to search through? I mean, I don't see a difference.
Yeah, I'm actually leaning towards. Yeah, in fact, I think even the guys that are named in the case should get a pass. If they're taking data that is publicly available, you know, anyone can sign up and get it. And you didn't do anything about it, and you create a significant value add, I don't see a problem with that, because then I don't see a difference between that and search bots. Do you really? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think in this case, there's a lot of opportunity out there. I mean, look at all the different sites that, you know, they're scraping for news articles, which are the trending topics. You know, there's a lot of AI, machine learning going on because they're scraping information. Look at scraping social networks. A lot of companies, like, for instance, I wouldn't put past companies like Amazon and Best Buy, where they would essentially go scrape competitors' websites to make sure that they understand, you know, the pricing that's out there today. I would not put it past these companies that they were not doing that already. You know, whether we know about it or not, I'm sure that they're doing it. Another thing is, for instance, right? I mean, they have to be doing it. There's no way that they have some person clicking around the websites every day.
Well, more directly, if you have one of those apps on your phone where you scan the barcode in the market, it will go and then display the prices at markets all around you.
Right.
That's all done through web scraping. And that's if you ask me, that's a significant value add. But the market would argue that they're taking business away from them.
Sure. Now let's look at the other flip of the coin. So, like, for instance, think of it from a, you know, big retailer standpoint, like a Best Buy or, you know, an online provider like Amazon or something. You know, they could be going out and scraping, you know, social networks as well as potentially scraping retailers' websites. So, for instance, I'm a TV manufacturer and I have all my TVs on my website. And so Amazon wants to see the difference between the TVs that are being sold on my website versus the ones that are actually on the company's manufacturer's website. There could be a difference. There could be new ones that they don't have. There could be old ones that they don't have. Amazon wants to know about that, or Best Buy wants to know about that. So I can almost guarantee that they have some kind of service saying maybe there's a difference. Maybe we should go and scrape their sites. Maybe we should go see what the trends are. Maybe we're missing out on some of this stuff. So again, I wouldn't put it past companies, corporations, startups, and other bot type networks that are doing this type of thing. So we'll have to see just how forward and how much litigation is going to happen in the future on this.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Bleep Burp actually has a really, really good point. Name a company that does not spy. If they even look at your web page, it could be spying. You know, the reality is, maybe the problem is we just have much better tools,
right,
to do competitive research. How's that sound?
Right. Yeah, and I think just a single person, I think it's a flip of a coin. Like, think about this. Like, I have hundreds of thousands of people. I distribute accounts, hundreds of thousands of people looking at that data versus I have hundreds of thousands of nodes, you know, distributed computing doing the same thing in a bot network. So I guess it could be analog in either way. So I don't know how far lawsuits like this will go, and if you can even stop it. But in the same sense, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Well, folks, that does it for the bites. Let's get to my personal favorite part of the show. And this is to bring a guest in to the Twilight Riot to put some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And in this case, it's Renu Upadhyay, Director of Product Marketing at VMware. Renu, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
So can you just tell a little bit about what VMware, you know, what they're having to offer here and what kind of the news that's coming out about VMware? What's their focus?
Sure. I just wanted to, first kind of acknowledge that, wow, this has been a very informative and educational session that I've been listening into you guys, sharing the day's news, because as a consumer, you know, I feel like that you're just inundated with data, like you just mentioned. And so when you think about, you know, all of us as consumers and all the choices that we have, and when we go into the enterprise environment, you know, I'm thinking, you know, is that world different? You know, you feel like you've entered a walled garden at that point. But the enterprise environment starting to shake up a lot as well. And that's where we are seeing a lot of this digital experience, all, you know, everything we're having with the web and data and mobile and how we consume services sort of come in to the enterprise environment, and people want that same experience. So at VMware, we talk about the concept of a digital workspace. And a lot of our announcements and innovations have really been around how do you take this consumer behavior that we all are exposed to on a daily basis in our personal lives, and then really translate them in the context of the enterprise. And then what IT can do to make that a lot more secure, a lot more easy for employees.
Right. So, like, we all know that, you know, employees, they have this simple way they want to access. They want to access a wide range of applications and devices and so on. How are some of your solutions, for instance, from a digital workspace perspective, how is it helping those types of organizations, those types of consumers and end users?
Absolutely. So when I joined VMware, you know, at the end of the day as an employee, you really want to access the application you need when you need it, right? And it may be based on your job. You're at your desk, or it may be if you're in sales, you're out on the site. So there's really a breadth of applications that employees are using. In fact, we see that employees want to bring in their own devices, but they also want to sometimes bring in their own applications. So if they're kind of fed up with the old way of working, where it's sort of like I update a spreadsheet, then I email it, I save it, but I want to do all of this in real time, and I just want to go out and source a cloud-based document or a cloud-based sort of project tool, they're starting to bring in their own applications as well. At the same time, the more the number of devices that I use as an employee, the more the number of applications I use, think about the number of passwords I have to manage. And if I'm ideally an evolved consumer and employee, my password's a little more complicated than 1, 2, 3, 4. So again, you're kind of balancing something that's simple with, you know, making sure that you're not compromising security along the way. So we have a platform, you know, where we deliver a single catalog experience where employees can access any of the applications that they need access to through this Workspace ONE platform. And they can really access it on any of the devices that they choose. So I'm sitting at my desk. I want to access my benefits application. I go in there, single sign on in, and I can access that application. I don't need to refer to my sticky note for my password anymore. And then I'm on the road. I realize the deadline has passed, or I'm very close to where that expense report needs to be approved. I can still access that on my mobile device as well. And it's very seamless. It's as easy as downloading something from an app store, or as easy as just going to a browser. So that's really the power of what we deliver. And the ability to do that irrespective of the app, whether it's a modern mobile app, a cloud app, or even your legacy Windows apps that we deliver through our virtualized portfolio.
Right. So you talk a little bit about some of the things that these solutions have, especially in a digital workspace perspective. You know, when we talk about a well-designed digital workspace, what does it look like? What does it offer? And you had some examples there. Does it help reduce my cost? How does it do that? And does it increase my security? How does it do that? You know, how does it allow me to bring my own device? That kind of thing.
Right. So a very important step is really thinking about, your employees are no longer all sitting in headquarters. Not everyone goes into IT when they join in, and then they're given a laptop. Mostly now, people are dispersed across the globe. Whether it's a retailer, whether it's a doctor in a healthcare setting, in many cases, they're not even employees of the company. In that case, what the digital workspace does is provides a very easy way to provision those devices. It provides a very cloud-centric way to deliver services, to deliver applications and security to those endpoints across the board, wherever that employee may be. At the same time, it really allows for IT for one place to access to manage access control. At the end of the day, what you're trying to do is you want to keep the bad actors out, but you want to make sure you don't let security get in the way of your employees accessing the information they need and when they need it. So you want to make sure that the policies you design are the ones that allow the flexibility so that they give employees access to the apps, but then they don't compromise security. So the digital workspace also makes sure that there is that one place to apply policies in a very consistent fashion. And at the end of the day, it's about self-service too. Every time you adopt a new technology, you don't want to create an IT headache where you're now getting a lot more help desk calls and now you're just, solving issues. So you want to make sure that you can deliver all this new technology, the new applications, the new devices, in a way such that it's easy for the employee in a very self-service sort of mode. So you can lessen some of that burden on you as IT organizations.
Right. And you talk a little bit about that. I mean, you said a little bit about how, you know, you don't want to make it hard for IT, especially to integrate some of the particular new solutions. And you said something about how you can, you know, you offer the ability to, you know, quickly single sign on. Does this types of solutions integrate directly with your, you know, your integrated identity that you already have, your, you know, identity manager, whether it's AD or any type of other solution?
Right. Absolutely, it does. So what we do is, and what's unique really is the fact that we sort of have this, you know, we've brought together mobility and identity, and that is we know sort of who you are, what device you are on, what are you trying to access, you know, where are you trying to access it. And based on that sort of, you know, contextual information, you can apply policy. And based on that, we also have, you know, we overlaid our identity solution. Now, a lot of customers obviously already have invested in some sort of, you know, whether it's an IDP or they have their, you know, Active Directory, and we integrate directly into that. The goal is, at the end of the day, you want to provide a simple way to access all the applications. And so when an employee, you know, goes to that unified catalog and they click on benefits, you know, they just simply tap on it. They're signed in automatically into that. And then at the back end is when our integrations come into play, whether you've, like I said, you've already invested in some sort of an IDP. If you've not, then we offer that capability. And we really start to deliver that information to you on your device of choice. So those are just some of the benefits that we provide, you know, especially in terms of simplifying that from an IT perspective as well.
So, Renu, let's shift gears just a little bit, go dive a little deeper into technology. You know, what I'm seeing here is obviously the virtual apps. This is very much looking, you know, like, well, what used to be called Rails, and now it has various flavors. The question that came up out of the chat room is, what kind of tools are available? You know, how much support does VMware give to developers to provide the seamless integration that we saw in that sample video?
Right. So when you talk about to developers, so what we have right now is we are able to extend some of these services, right? So if you are building your own app, we will have the ability to extend the capabilities around security and identity via open APIs and SDKs that we, you know, we put out there on GitHub. We have VMware Code where we, you know, make those services available for enterprise developers to take advantage of. You know, we realize that, you know, one of the beauties of the solution actually is the fact that it really interoperates with different ecosystems, right? When you think about a real enterprise environment, it's no longer, you know, I buy all Apple and that's all that I have, or I'm just subscribed to the, you know, the Google and the Android stack and that's all I have, or, you know, it's all Windows. Employees bring a mix and match of technologies. And so what we do is, because of our deep integrations with each of these platform vendors and a very API-centric extensions that we have built into the platform, we are extending these services to the developers so that they can then take advantage of, you know, as they build their own applications as well.
So speaking of ecosystems, you guys had an announcement recently about a cooperative effort with Google. I'm assuming that's Chrome OS. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So when you think again about, you know, the enterprise environment, traditionally everyone managed mobile endpoints, right? But really, you know, we should not sort of ignore the way, you know, our traditional laptops, desktops are evolving as well. And Chrome, you know, Chromebooks are a great example of that, very cloud first, very, you know, mobile first from that sense. And what we announced is an expanded partnership on really two fronts. One is, you know, extending that Workspace ONE single catalog experience to, you know, through Chrome OS so that any enterprise employee using Chromebooks, you know, on their Chrome OS can use Workspace ONE as a single catalog to access all of their applications. The second component of that announcement was really around the ability to extend your legacy, you know, your older Win32 applications that are now virtualized using a Horizon portfolio of virtualization and now deliver that through the same Workspace ONE experience. So again, very powerful in terms of, you know, where Google's going into the enterprise and also where we see value, because we want to be agnostic to the platform. We really want to support what the enterprise is asking for. And, you know, that's what we were bringing to bear with Google.
So, Renu, another chat room question. How about Linux? We just had a show just recently with Ericom talking about their new secure browser, which is basically a virtualized Linux machine so that that's been jailed and so forth, so that the users can browse. And even if they do click on some bad acting code, that it will be jailed to that area. Can you address that in this new ecosystem that you're talking about?
I'm not very familiar with the Linux browser, honestly. So I don't think I can comment on that. But the whole idea or the notion of virtualization is the ability to keep your data in the data center and sort of give a view into that on your environment. So when there are bad actors, when the device is compromised, you know, or jailbroken, or you're trying to access it from a location, you know, that may be suspect, you never leave the data on the device, right? So the idea is that the information is always securely stored in the data center. Now, we are taking that a level further where, you know, through our product portfolio around NSX that we have, we can actually segment and even block off access to certain segments of the network. So we can say, oh, here's Renu. She happens to be in this location that is, you know, that is not deemed secure by corporate policy, and she's trying to access a resource that also, you know, has sensitive corporate information. I'm going to sort of quarantine her only to a certain segment of the network and open only that up to her versus everything else. So we call this micro-segmentation at the network layer as well. And so, you know, so that's the kinds of capabilities that we are building all the way up the stack from network to the device to the application from a security perspective.
Right. So kind of another quick question about kind of compatibility and integration. So we know that most companies, most people, they have kind of a set of their anchor applications like email and calendars and maybe some pricing and customer type related mm-hmm. applications. How easy is it for me as an organization to kind of integrate those types of applications that I'm already using into this type of environment?
Right. And, you know, that's sort of the most common use case. What we see is that in many cases, there's a mix of applications. There's applications that I buy off the shelf, or there are applications that I have built internally. The idea is that irrespective of where that application is built, you can use the Workspace ONE, you know, the catalog experience to deliver all of those applications. In fact, you know, at VMware too, VMware IT, I have to say, you know, has got a phenomenal, you know, staff in terms of the applications they churn out. We have an application that just has aggregated all of my approvals into one app. And now when they want to roll that application out, all they have to say to all of us as employees or as managers who have approval workflows is go to Workspace ONE and you can access this application. So really, it's become that one-stop shop. And you can think about when IT builds new applications, when they change applications behind the scene, they don't need to train you and me as employees and say, oh, now you need to go to a new link, or now you need to download something else, or this, you know, you need to go to your intranet and go to HR and then click on benefits, and now you will get the application. They just say, go to Workspace ONE, and all the applications you need that we are making available to you as IT are over there. So that's that self-service conversation I was having. So it has to be as dead simple as go to an app store, download something. So when I'm on mobile, I go to the app store, I download Workspace ONE. When I'm on my laptop, I go to a browser and I'm done. So that's the power of really simplifying that and taking that burden off IT. So every time they want to add a new app, they don't have to worry about the distribution of that app, the training of the employees around where they go to get that app. They just say, go to Workspace ONE, and it's all right there, and single sign-on is enabled. So really very easy and very powerful in that sense.
Right. So I think you kind of mentioned this too, is why during your session there is around, mm-hmm. IT might have their own applications. They might build their own applications, mm-hmm. And construct them. What's kind of the process? If I'm going to build an application or I'm going to develop an application, do I have to do something special to integrate to this type of workspace, or is it easy as just kind of deploying it to the server and it's ready to go?
Yeah, it's more kind of adding that and deciding what policies you want to enable for that application. So, for example, I use the example of that approval application that our own IT department built. Because it's got sensitive corporate information, when they added that application, to sort of the app store or the catalog, they set certain policies around, I'd like Renu's device to be managed or, to have a certain level of security, because she's accessing pretty sensitive corporate information and expenses and things like that. If it's a simple application that, there's no, it's a Cisco WebEx or it's Skype for Business or it's a collaboration, any collaboration application like that. And IT says, no, there's not going to be a data leakage problem here. I just bring that application into my console, through my console, and I select my policies and I say, allow access, don't need Renu to download anything on her device, and she has access and she has single sign-on enabled. So we're really trying to integrate, through that single console as well, how you not only sort of ingest the application, whether it's from a public app store or a self-created, internally created app, but also then apply policy to that when you roll it out so that it gets consumed in the right way and the security policies get applied in the right way.
Right. So we all know that, we've heard the fancy word, GDPR, and that's kind of in the wind right now. People are worried about it, and the whole idea of general data protection regulation, how it's being enforced. How especially around compliance and security, you've kind of talked about it a little bit. I'm curious, how does a digital workspace help with this, and maybe to help my organization meet compliance regulations, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think, the first step is really when you think about your data, GDPR is all about the data, right? And it's about the protection of that data. And the data kind of has its own life cycle. It kind of goes through, there's data is created, it's also shared, it's deleted at certain times. And the first step is really knowing where that data is and what is that life cycle look like? Who's accessing the data? What are they doing then with that data? And, are they deleting that data? And when you have visibility into that, because now you are managing the device, and not just when I say device, I mean any device that's part of your digital workspace, whether it's your mobile device or it's your desktop device, the digital workspace platform gives you that view into the devices and what data they're accessing. And because you know who has access to that information, because you've set that policy as IT and who has access to those apps, you again have access to knowing what's happening with those. In fact, you can even set policies that, prevent deletion. One of the sort of common things also is, disabling, cut, copy, paste kind of restrictions. So, because a digital workspace spans any end user computing technology, be it mobile or desktop, across your different ecosystems, and be it apps, whether they are mobile SaaS apps or web apps or virtual apps, you have better visibility and insight into that data. And because you have that, you can then track what its life cycle is and where it's going. And then that can help you enforce compliance as well, because then you can disable certain actions if you think there's a risk to that data or it's going to compromise privacy.
Wow, really cool stuff. You know what? It's almost time for VM World. And mm-hmm. sadly, I don't have travel money this time. But you have any good teasers for our viewers?
Yes, we are very excited about VMworld. This is it's definitely an amazing show. And as an end user computing sort of marketing person, I'm very stoked, because to me, end user computing really spans across ecosystems. So we have great announcements that build on, across our ecosystem of devices. So when you think about you know, other shows in the past, a lot of them address, you know, there's of course, there's Google I.O. or you go to WWDC or you go to, you know, a show to learn just about virtualization. But really, the digital workspace goes across all of these silos. And I think, you know, when we think about VMware's role in that, our job is to stitch these silos. So we're really excited to bring that to our audience and show them how we stitch all these silos and really think it's the premier end-user computing show, because end-user computing, again, as I said, is no longer about one or the other computing technology. It's about all of it that's coming into your environment. And this is really that one place you can go to. We have a phenomenal lineup of sessions. We have a great keynote with tons of cool demos that show how we are bringing these technologies together, not just for the employees to really get them to do a lot more to be successful at their jobs, but also for IT to take away that cost and complexity. So lots of action-packed demos, lots of great customer testimonials, you know, those bleeding edge customers who are going through it today, and best practices that they will be sharing, because they're seeing their environment really transcend across these silos. And they're looking to this as a one-stop shop to learn everything that's happening in the world of end-user computing and the digital workspace. Right. So I hope we can see you there. And I'm sorry if you can't join us, Brian. We'll have lots of videos and podcasts that we'll share with you.
Fabulous. You know, I'm actually not far from retiring, so that means I'm not going to have problems with managers saying, no, you can't travel. It's like, dude, this is killing me. So anyway, we're getting close to the end. VMware is changing. You know, obviously NSX, mm-hmm. I've been seeing all kinds of teasers. Is there anything more you can tell us about NSX? You know, what kind of mm-hmm. new things are happening?
Right. You know, and I think you're right in that VMware is definitely changing. You know, now I definitely can't share what NSX is doing because I don't want to steal their thunder or comment on their behalf. But really, VMware as a company, in terms of we really connect those mission critical services, you know, to employees, right? That computing used to sit in the data center, and now we've extended that to mobile, right, and cloud. And now when you think about, you know, where we've been, I think the opportunity is phenomenal in terms of where we are going. For me, as an end user, I love this space because I get to play with this technology on a daily basis, and I get to put my employee hat on and say, this is not as easy, or wow, this is really easy. I wonder what it took IT to deliver this. And, you know, and so I get to see both sides, you know, the employee consumer side, and I also get to see what it takes for IT to deliver that. So definitely, you know, I think VMware is in a very unique position that I'm personally very excited to be part of this team, you know, to kind of bring some of that technology to you know, other employees like me, you know, because I think it's really powerful and can transform how they do their jobs.
Fantastic. So I do. There's a bunch of questions kind of coming in from the chat room. We're honestly running out of time, but I do want to throw one more at you. And sure. One of them is about, you know, if I'm an organization, I want to start my using digital workspaces. Where do I go? What do I do? What's the barrier of entry? How do I get started? You know, do I have to get my CTO or CIO kind of, you know, on board? What, you know, what kind mm-hmm. of the cost? Where do those come from? What do I do to get started?
Right. Fair enough. And I think, you know, because a digital workspace is a big concept, sometimes it can feel overwhelming. I think I always, you know, start by saying, think about where your strategic priority is, or find projects where you can deploy, win, and show that success before you can move to the next thing, right? Digital workspace brings together that mobility and desktop experience. So think about, what's that first problem you're looking to solve? Are you dealing with mergers and acquisitions where you have a new slew of employees all the time and you want to give them one place where you can quickly onboard them and give them access to apps? Or is the problem you're trying to solve that you have, you know, you're rolling out new devices and you want to manage them securely from a cloud model, and that's what you're trying to do? Are you trying to enable a remote workforce and you're looking for technology, you know, that may be more bring your own device centric, and that's an area you want to tackle first? So the idea is to really think about what is that first problem you want to solve? Because frankly, at the end of the day, if you have a problem you're looking to solve, you have a value proposition and you'll get funding for that, right? And you can show success because nothing shows well like success. So find that first use case you want to go after. And the idea is that address that use case, but now you know that when you've invested in this digital workspace platform, you've kind of set that foundation to now add on other use cases. So you may have started with just mobile, just building out your mobile strategy, delivering mobile apps in a great way. But you have that same platform as you start to add on your SaaS apps. You have that same platform as you then take on your Windows apps through virtualization. So again, you know, start through a project is my recommendation. Get the funding, show the success. Get end user adoption. You have to get that. That has to be part of your project plan from the get-go, and then build on to that. And that's really how you can really make this a reality.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of the best dang enterprise tech show, and according to 9 out of 10 digital workspaces. I do want to thank our guests for today, dropping some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. The director of product marketing from VMware, Renu Apadhyay. Thank you so much for coming to the show today. Really cool stuff. We had some really great questions from the chat room, really good engagement. Can you tell the audience at home where you can find your work, where they can find you, where they can find a little bit more about VMware and VMware World, that kind of thing?
Sure, absolutely. So, you can definitely go to, vmware.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I love hearing personal stories about where you are in your journey as well in terms of a digital workspace. You can find me on Twitter, Renu Upadhyay 3. That's my Twitter handle. But really, I would recommend start with the website, start with vmware.com and then going to digital workspace. And you'll start to hear a lot from us in this area because we really think at the end of the day, if we all do our jobs, if we are motivated, inspired, and do our jobs well, that's when we can really transform our companies. It's all about the people. So let's get motivated. Let's get inspired together and really take the power of digital workspace to do that. So I'm very excited about this.
Thank you again, Renu, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Of course, I can't do this show without my co-host in crime, and I want to thank our tireless producer for this week Enterprise Tech, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, what you're doing, what you're up to?
Well, I am Chibert at twit.tv. Feel free to drop me a line, especially if you've got show ideas. Yes, JJ, I am trying to catch up with some of your suggestions. We are dropping lines on different people. Some are answering, some aren't. We'll see. I'm also on Twitter, ADVNETLAB. And oh, by the way, sadly, my MacBook Pro is in repair again. All those audio problems we were having the last couple weeks seem to be linked to the motherboard. So we're giving Apple a second try. I'm really looking forward to it because I had just upgraded to VMware Fusion Pro 8.5, and I really wanted to start migrating it into my my vCenter system. So, oh well, such is life.
Well, they always say the third time's a charm, so let's hopefully you don't have to get there.
Yeah, there you go.
Folks, I also want to thank you, of course. You tune in each and every week. You are our supporters of This Week in Enterprise Tech. This is why we continue the show week after week. And of course, we want to make it easy for you to subscribe and watch and listen. Go ahead and go right now to twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all of our back episodes, our show notes, all the information about the show and the guests. Of course, you also find that magic button there to the right. Allows you to subscribe to our show, whether it's a format of your choice, audio, video, HD audio, HD video. Of course, on the device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. And also, don't be afraid to share Twiet with your friends and family and coworkers. This is some good stuff, so we want to make sure you're sharing it out. Also, remember, we do the show live each and every week at 1:30 Friday Pacific time. You can come watch us live at live.twit.tv. And, of course, if you're going to watch us live, you might as well jump into the live chat room as well, irc.twit.tv. Each and every week we have pretty amazing discussions in there. In fact, a lot of our questions that came from this episode came from the chat room. Some really great people in there and offering some really great suggestions and questions. So come visit us and be part of the Twiet Riot. Also, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at LouMM. Where you can find all the things that I'm working on and what I'm doing. You can pitch me some show notes as well. I can forward them on to Chibert. As well as don't forget to visit my work, of course, the things that I'm working on at dev.office.com. And also check out all the great things about the Microsoft Graph out there as well. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, thank you to Leo and Lisa for allowing us to do this each and every week and supporting us. As well as thank you to the engineers at Twit. Thank you for allowing us to make this show possible. And, of course, thank you to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi. And, of course, thank you to the TD this week. Kevin, can you tell the folks at home what you're doing over there at Twit?
Hey, guys. I am TDing and editing this week. Nothing special, but feeling fresh.
And nothing special. You're nothing special. Kevin's a good guy, and he helps us out each and every week. And I want to thank you, too, Kevin. Thank you so much. Until next time. Folks, I am Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.